On the website, an extension with communication support. And the reason I'm mentioning it is if anything just comes of this, or where you want to cross link or work in history, or we can link to you,
this is what we'd like to do. Joe Spillane and myself actually wrote a proposal to Robert Wood Johnson for this project that we weren't successful on. I mean, it's hard. We're historians, and it's a very different kind of field, and yet we think it's very important that addiction scientists be on the historical record, and not just for ourselves and our own projects, but also more generally. And so we are seeking to support this project. What I have done, I think, close to 10 interviews here, and I had done 5 last summer, and we'd like to have those interviews accessible. The web would be great, of course, for them. That would be the ideal. And so we are trying to figure out how to do that, and so I may well be looking you up later for that purpose.
What's neat is we've got good support. We've got professional support working with us on the communications package. And we think it'll be we've got some ways to get people to the site, because we've got some neat folks. We've got Addiction Art, which is really cool. I mean, an incredible addiction. One of our innovators has done brilliant nationally shown art, and the former Surgeon General, Dr. Who, has done 2 keynote addresses, one of the National Press Club on addiction, and also some public health service spots in the past and now in the next month. So we'll be able to put on other sites, see what Dr. Poop has to say about addiction. So we should go get people.
Yeah.
Okay, we should. That's just kind of a background.
That's maybe, great background, actually. I'm going to put this down here because I'm thinking it may be easier to catch your voice over here. I'm not sure. We'll see how this works.
And just so we, so I don't, because I could talk for a couple of days, so just so I don't waste a lot of your time, what do you know about me, or what do you want to get from me? Why are you interviewing me?
I'm interviewing you in part because, I mean, you're sort of one of those people tobacco as an addictive, nicotine as an addictive substance, so I think of you as a sort of, formative in that area.
Okay, so you want to focus more on tobacco and nicotine.
Well, no. Because my personal interest is actually in the ARC and how research priority setting sort of takes place within the intramural program.
Sure.
Is an interest.
Actually, tobacco is a great example. I assume you have or will talk to Don Jasinski.
Yes.
Ed Johnson.
You know, Ed, I connected with him. We haven't set an appointment.
But he's on the list.
He's on the list. I've done an extensive interview last summer with Don. And, so what I'm interested in you doing is sort of filling in what life was like in the ARC during that transitional, when you began. If you could start there and talk a little bit first, though, about your own pathway to addiction research.
Sure. Okay. You're running?
We're running.
Okay. I was actually trained in addiction research. I mention that because people get into the field by many paths.
Yes.
And Nixon had 2 major wars, Vietnam and the war on drugs. The war on drugs was largely because of his concern about crime. And he saw people with addictions as being criminals. And so that got him into addiction. He was also concerned about addiction because of reports that drug use was heavy in Vietnam, and he was afraid that as the war wound down, the nation would be flooded by military personnel who were drug using and would turn to crime in the United States. Well, that was basically it. So he worked with Jerry Jaffe and others, as you probably know, set up SAODAP, the Special Action Office, to do something. Part of that whole effort was recognizing that our nation needed an infrastructure. We needed people that knew something about addiction. And one of the good decisions that were made, I think, with the help of Jerry Jaffe and others, was that addiction wasn't just chemistry, it wasn't just society, it wasn't just psychology, it was everything come together. And so they set up a psychopharmacology training program at the University of Minnesota. And I had a public health service fellowship into the program for graduate school. So it was wonderful. We were trained in the medical school in psychology and pharmacology and with many aspects of addiction. So my graduate work, my undergraduate was related to alcohol, and alcohol is an addictive drug.
So this was an undergraduate fellowship?
Well, no, my fellowship was graduate, but I was lucky enough to get a research assistant position to help pay my way as an undergraduate in the laboratory that was actually doing this stuff. So that got me in the field in about 1971. And then I did a fellowship with the National Council on Alcoholism on animal models. And the focus was, what is the biological part? And at that time, a lot of people were assuming that alcohol was basically a unique human social psychological phenomenon. This is right at the kind of this transition where the understanding of addiction was making the transition from it's something that is people with weak morals, personality deficits, social pressures, and then the understanding that biology might have a role. So it was that era. So our work that showed that animals could become addicted to alcohol helped show that, hey, the problem basically is if you have a nervous system, but all these other factors make a difference. I was doing animal work, and I got a call in 1977, an offer to come to Johns Hopkins Medical School and do human work on tobacco.
From whom?
Yes. And
who did you get the call
from? Roland Griffiths, George Bigelow, and Joe Brady, Maxine Sitzer, the Brady Bunch. And Joe Brady, if you haven't talked to him, he's got to be high on the list.
I'm going to go, I think, spend some time with him.
That's Vincent Brady.
Oh, that's his son?
No. But Joe Brady, Joe's name is Joseph Vincent Brady, and Vincent Brady is named after Joe. And it was my wife's idea, because Joe is an incredible person, as a humanist, as a scientist, philosopher, everything, and a friend. My first son, we liked the name, but also it had meaning, is Travis. And Joe Brady had two incredible postdocs, Bob Schuster and Travis Thompson, who did the monkey model.
Yes,
okay.
And I've just spent days with Bob, actually, interviewing him across several days.
So, 1978, I went to Johns Hopkins to help them develop a tobacco laboratory. What was interesting here is that NIDA informally was the National Institute on Illicit Drugs.
Mm-hmm.
And some Roland Griffiths and the Johns Hopkins group had done some preliminary work with tobacco, and they got a grant that was, the title was Licit and the Illicit Drugs of Abuse. Now, they wanted to focus more on tobacco, but they had to really slip it in as a component, licit and illicit drugs of abuse. At that time, the prevailing notion of tobacco is that basically it's a habit, which was officially codified by the 1964 Surgeon General's report that said it's not an addiction, it's a habit. And because there were clearly so many mediators of the behavior, the importance of biology wasn't clear. So we started out basically saying, what should it look like if it was drug addiction? And does it fit? So what do? You do studies to find out, does the drug make a difference? Does the dose make a difference? What are patterns look like? Does it look like capricious, spontaneous behavior that occurs at the whim of the person? Or does it fit regular patterns? And drugs, each drug class tends to have patterns that are associated. So to the drug addiction researcher, it's a little bit like the cardiologist looking at the ECG strip. So we look at patterns. We look at what happens when you deprive smokers. We look at what happens if you preload them with nicotine and give them more cigarettes. Later, nicotine gum became available as an experimental tool before it was on the market. What happens if you load people up with nicotine? What happens if you give them a nicotine blocker? So it's basically, us and other laboratories started doing this about this time. So very quickly, what started emerging is that smoking looked a lot like stimulant-taking behavior, but not just like stimulant-taking behavior. In some ways, it looked like opiate-taking behavior. It was so regular and steady. At about this time, the Addiction Research Center was moving to Baltimore. And the process started in the late 70s, when the prisoners could no longer be used as subjects. So you know the story there, how they got to Baltimore. Where tobacco entered was the Secretary of Health under Jimmy Carter was Joe Califano. And Joe Califano said, you know, we've got hundreds of thousands of people dying of tobacco. At the very least, it's a habitual form of drug taking. It might even be addictive. And in fact, research by a number of people, like Murray Jarvik and others, are suggesting that this might really be an honest-to-goodness form of drug addiction. But in any case, there's a drug involved in some way, shape, or form. Hey, Jim, how are you doing?
Oh, hi.
Sorry.
Somehow we crossed signals.
Well,
I was being generous. Could we do it tomorrow morning? I interview Mary Jean Creek at 10:45. Can we do it before that? Would 9 o'clock work?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
Yeah, I think so.
Do you want me to write it down? Sorry, we missed yesterday, and I wrote him a note and told him to come down here.
Actually, I had a postdoc offer to join Jim Woods, and it wasn't all completely wrapped up. And then I got the human offer at Hopkins.
Why were you in such demand? Was it?
I just worked hard.
Hoping that works out. Okay.
Okay. So Joe Califano said, you know, we should be looking at tobacco more systematically. It's a major public health problem. And we've got to find out what's the role of nicotine, what can we do about it. Bob DuPont had been the NIDA director, and DuPont had said, you know, tobacco looks like an addictive drug. We should do something. There were a number of other people at NIDA, Norman Krasnogor and others, who were saying, you know, we can't ignore the fact that there is a drug, and there's animal studies that indicate that at the very least it is a psychoactive drug. We don't know if it meets all criteria as an addictive drug. There were several gaps if you're going to take a hard-nosed science approach. At the same time, psychiatrists were saying, you know, we don't understand all the science, but there's a syndrome that looks like dependence, that looks like withdrawal. And in 1980, tobacco dependence and withdrawal ended up in the APA DSM-3. They called it tobacco dependence and tobacco withdrawal because they suspected an important role of nicotine, but as they said, it's not clear that it's all nicotine or that it's mainly nicotine, but it's clear that cigarettes produce dependence and withdrawal. So the clinicians were ahead of the scientists. They were saying, scientists, you got to figure it out for us, but there's something there. So all of this is happening. NIDA started having some conferences that led to NIDA monographs. And this was a really, I think, neat...
Upstairs?
Yeah. That's Vincent Brady. Huh? That's Vincent Brady. He's... Huh? Yeah, I've been teaching him everything I know. So this was a neat process. It was not just a whim, get NIDA engaged in nicotine. It was people looking at the magnitude of the public health problem, reading the tea leaves of something's going on, that there could be a major impact on public health if we could understand it and control it. And so they had consensus conferences, and those led to NIDA monographs. In the 1970s, there were four or five NIDA monographs that included tobacco or that focused on tobacco. And these were basically pulling together bits and pieces of research, EEG research, rat research showing that the animals could discriminate nicotine, research showing that animals might self-administer, but it hadn't been studied enough to nail it. So all these monographs said it is looking like nicotine itself might meet criteria as an addictive drug, but we don't really know, is it a reinforcer in animals, does it meet all criteria? Is the withdrawal syndrome nicotine specific? And you talked to Don about abuse liability testing. What would happen if you plug nicotine into the human models and said, let's pretend it is a novel drug? Would it meet the objective criteria? And so all of this is happening late 70s and laying the groundwork.
Were you using, you weren't trained as a behavioral pharmacologist?
Yes.
You were? Okay. All right. So that that language, is it a reinforcer you were using at the time?
Yes. Yes, our questions are very specific. Is it a reinforcer in the sense of a behavioral pharmacologist? And what that led to was Joe Califano saying, NIDA do something. Then William Pollan came in as director of NIDA, I guess 78, I think, about that, 78, 79. And another person was involved. Joe Califano had set up the Office on Smoking and Health and expanded it and put a guy named John Pinney in charge of it. John Pinney had been in the public health service early 70s and helped form NIDA. He's one of the people, he and a number of other people, Parse Bestman and others, worked together and said, okay, we need two drug institutes, an alcohol, a drug, and it makes sense to make them work with mental health, so we'll put them all together under the Substance Abuse and Health Administration, Mental Health Administration. So they got together with Bill Pollan, and Pollan said, yes, this looks like a major problem. We need a science base. We need a science foundation, and that's what NIDA does, is the science. So he then directed the extramural people, like Norm Krasnagar, start opening up the doors to grantees to write grants and at least get tobacco, nicotine on the radar screen. So grants started coming in extramurally. Intramurally, this is where, for me, it gets really exciting, because that was still approaching, that was in the era of the peak, the zenith in my opinion, of the Addiction Research Center. Where the Addiction Research Center could do work that nobody else could do, and it could do it fast, and it had an incredible team. And so I worked with Roland Griffiths and others at Hopkins for about 2 years, was ready to go to another university, and Don Jasinski ran into Roland Griffiths and said, I've been directed by Pollen to find out if nicotine is truly addictive and make sure the Addiction Research Center brings its resources together to find out. So he recruited Steve Goldberg from Harvard to do the animals work. And he recruited, they recruited me to do the human work, and later Edith London to do brain imaging work. So they figured that'd help nail it. So Don Jasinski looked at the data that we had and he said, you know, it does look like a lot like a real addiction, but we have to make sure the animal studies fill in all the blanks. And Goldberg's in charge of that, and he wanted me to collaborate. Same token, we've got to make sure that nicotine, what does it look like in the human models? So we set up intravenous human experiments using people with histories of drug addiction, because they're the ones that can tell you, what does it look like? Does it meet criteria as an addictive drug? We did the basic models in humans in the early 1980s, and we even did a self-administration model in humans where people were, Steve Goldberg and I did this collaboratively, people were hooked up with an infusion pump. They could press a lever and get nicotine injections. And we could vary the dose. We could vary the interval between doses. We could make them pay more. We could do everything that the behavioral pharmacologists were doing with animals.
Right. And where were they? What kind of setting?
In a room that had basically like a modern office cubicle. So it had easy access by the physicians and everything. Nicotine is actually a fairly safe drug to work with compared to a lot of drugs, because at a fairly low dose relative to the dangerous doses, it makes you very nauseated and dizzy. So long before you get into a serious problem, you get dizzy and nauseated. So it's kind of an early warning that if you're self-administering it, back off. And if you're an investigator giving the dose, back off.
Back to something you said, because I talked to Chris Ellen Johansson yesterday, and she talked about the difficulties of doing work within the intramural program and the slowness of the IRB, etc. You said that there was a time when you could do work fast.
I was lucky to be there during the zenith, and thank goodness for public health that we got these studies done in the early 1980s.
And so, what do you think, what allowed for that?
There was a focus on public health. Public health was right at the top, and everybody there cared deeply about public health. So that's the driving motivation. And then there was the belief that public health could be served with a strong science foundation. And everybody that was there understood that our job was to provide the science. The Addiction Research Center also had been a leader in the ethics of human research. So it was working out ethical methods early in the game. And the Addiction Research Center had physicians working closely with non-scientist physicians and scientist physicians, so we could do the work safely. And the Hopkins Institutional Review Board Hopkins being one of the absolute world pioneers in biomedical research, understood that a lot of research is tricky, risky, and frankly, a lot of our research is much less invasive than a lot of things that are done in general medicine, where you're doing spinal taps, all kinds of exotic things in general medical research. So ours was not out that side that window at all. So we made incredible progress in a couple of years.
The ARC had been working out ethical methods for human research and was sort of at the forefront of that. Could you tell me more specifically what you mean?
Sure, and I'm going to just mention a couple of things, and you might want to get back to Chuck Gorodetsky.
Sure, I actually also interviewed him.
Ask him specifically about this, because Chuck was one of the people that headed a project to document what drug effects look like. There is an archive that where people were filmed going into withdrawal, DTs. I mean, things that today you would look at it and say, how could they possibly have done that? Well, back when they were doing it, we didn't know what it was. 15 years from now, people might say, you know, some of that nicotine withdrawal research was pretty dicey. Not an innocuous thing for some people. But so how you do it with informed consent, how you make sure you're providing good patient care. The irony is, yet the good care that people were getting, now my son's going to fool around. This is his reinforcer.
He just lets it gets to let it go.
You bet. Think he's having fun?
Yeah, he looks much more like he's having fun.
Well, he loves the other things that he's been working on, but he knows that Friday is a competition, so now he's... Anyway, one of the things that the prisons recognized was, hey, people going for this research are getting better care, better food, better health care, better everything. Maybe that's coercive in its own right. But it was a balancing act. So talk to Chuck Gorodetsky. I think the important thing is they had people that cared, that were really blazing the trail, and it is always a balance. How do you provide care without so much care that the care itself is coercive? Not a simple thing. And this faces every drug abuse researcher. What do you offer to compensate for harm, suffering? I mean, not harm, but to compensate for discomfort and inconvenience, and then to protect against, what I meant to say, protect against harm. Tricky balance. So what was really exciting to me, though, is on the tobacco, is that NIDA followed a systematic process, extramurally, intramurally, brought people together. It created this bubbling cauldron at the Addiction Research Center of brain scientists, Edie London, behavioral animal scientist, Steve Goldberg, human, myself, working with people like Don Jasinski, Chuck Hartson, who blazed the trail with the Addiction Research Center inventory. And that helped us find out what kind of a footprint does nicotine leave compared to other drugs we use. And the footprint was, A, it was novel, just like amphetamine is not the same as alcohol, heroin, and cocaine, but has more similarities with cocaine than the others. Nicotine had similarities with all those drugs, but differences. And by 1982, Bill Pollan was ready to go before Congress when Henry Waxman was having hearings on tobacco. And Surgeon General Coop had come in and Farcoo, he had a long history of concern about tobacco disease, but didn't understand it as an addiction. At this time, the administration had changed. So, Reagan is in. Tobacco was not a priority, but the machine had already started. The extramural machine had started, was moving, and is hard to turn back. The intramural machine was moving, could be stopped more effectively, but was still moving forward. So in 1982, Holland went before Congress. We developed a testimony, said tobacco meets criteria and is an addictive drug, and he was urging that addiction should be a warning, that the NIDA studies had nailed it.
And he went before Congress, you mean in an appropriations?
In a hearing on tobacco. And the Office of Management and Budget reviewed his testimony and took out the word addiction and greatly softened the testimony. But the core testimony survived. And then the Office on Smoking and Health of the Centers for Disease Control said, hey, we should, if NIDA is saying this is dependence producing, let's do a public health service pamphlet. They did it, and the pamphlet concluded that NIDA met criteria as a dependence producing drug, and it said, you know, and in plain language, that means it's addictive. That got Surgeon General Koop involved, because Koop said, hey, if it's addictive, we've got to get the public to understand it, we've got to be doing something to help them, you know, this is important in prevention and treatment. It's like finding out malaria just doesn't happen, that there are mosquitoes. And once you understand that there's mosquitoes, then it gives you a way to help prevent and treat. And when you understand that there's a spirochetan mosquito, I mean, this was analogous to understanding the mosquitoes, the spirochetan, everything that transmits malaria, if you're going to prevent and treat it. And it was really exciting to be part of that. Then, unfortunately, the tobacco industry, and now the documents are available on the internet, but the tobacco industry registered concern, as we now know, going back to the 70s, when Robert DuPont said tobacco might be an addictive drug. They started following NIDA's activities, and it turned out that there's documents that show that they followed my activities and Goldberg's activities. And in 1984, I believe, the White House drug abuse director, Carlton Turner, visited the Addiction Research Center. And he specifically wanted to see the tobacco work. We were incredibly proud and incredibly excited that the White House wanted, was so interested. After he completed his visit, have you talked to Jerry Jaffe yet?
Not yet. He's another one I want to take some time with. So I think I'll do him and Joe Brady together. And
I'll send you the email me if I forget, but David Kessler meticulously but briefly documented this in his 2000 book, because it had never been published before, and he again meticulously verified the facts with Jaffe and Carl Turner. In brief, Jerry called me into his office after Carl Turner finished his visit and said Carl Turner had told him that if NIDA had so much money to waste on a drug that even his wife knew was not addictive, that maybe NIDA did not need such a generous budget the following year. This was before the death of Len Bias. And it was when NIDA's budget was very tight and small, and the small cut would have hurt a lot. Jerry said, I won't order you to shut down your studies, but you have to recognize that this could threaten NIDA's budget. we agreed that I would not shut down the studies per se, but that we would finish up subjects that were in the pool and not, and what that meant was not completing the studies.
How did you feel at that point?
My reaction was, I thought this just happened in Russia. I thought, we're being told that we can't study something that is a major public health problem because there seems to be politics going on. It was frustrating, didn't understand it. Fortunately, the U.S. military was then interested in yellow rain and the possibility that yellow rain in the Middle East was might involve chemical nerve agents. So they set up a tri-services Army, Navy, Air Force project to come up with protective medicines against nerve agents. One of the things you want to know about is, will the protective medicines affect behavior and adversely affect troop performance? That guy over there, Dave Penatar, was in the Army at Letterly at the time. He was working on it. This was a big thing. So a lot of the nerve agents work on the cholinergic nervous system, including the nicotinic. And we were supposed to look at drugs, and I was in charge of the Addiction Research Center's human military performance testing. And so our job was to look at medicines that might be used by the troops to protect them against nerve agents.
When did that become an ARC area?
1985. And the ARC and the field of public health or drug addiction benefited enormously because we were being asked to use our understanding of how drugs interact with behavior to help the military understand potential adverse effects of medicines on behavior. So say you're going to give an atropine injector, the military needed to know, is that going to mean if your radar operator can't see what's happening? Should pilots take it? Can, you know, it's this real world trade-off. How much do you use? And if the troops that take the medicines, are they now safer but debilitated? So some real world questions because the military was, their first concern was protect the troops, but understand the medicines. And so they helped us set up an expensive behavioral performance testing lab.
Yeah. Was that, to your knowledge, the first military collaboration with the ARC?
Don't know. Ask Chuck Gordetsky, because there was, and the obvious drug that he asked me about is LSD. But it was a major public collaboration. We were excited as scientists because the military had enormous capacity to do behavioral performance testing. They didn't understand addictive drugs well. And it was a wonderful collaboration because it brought together their skills and performance batteries that were relevant to complicated performance. And it married with our understanding of psychoactive drugs. And so we started doing studies, and then some of the first drugs that we were ready to really look at for the military were basic things like atropine and scopolamine, things that are used for motion sickness, cold medications, and so forth. But there were delays on the Army side of getting it approved. So in the delays, there were discussions. What do we do now that we've got the performance laboratory set up? And we concluded that there were, other cholinergic agonists and antagonists, nicotine and methamphetamine. Mm-hmm. And the military performance group thought, A, these are cholinergic drugs. It'll get us in business, get the system exercised. Two, they were recognizing that tobacco was a major problem in the military, in the health of the troops. But also, they were concerned about tobacco withdrawal. And they needed to know, is it real? Because a huge cadre of pilots, for example, in the Air Force and Navy pilots, were snuff dippers, chewing tobacco and snuff. You know why? Chewing tobacco and snuff had been literally a dying practice in men age 50 and over in the 70s. And a company called U.S. Smokeless Tobacco that made Copenhagen recognized that it had a bad image, and Copenhagen made young people sick, and they wouldn't use it. So they developed what they called starter products to introduce people to what they called the graduation process. And then to give it a better image, they really pushed it in baseball players. So all of a sudden, late 70s, they turned the pattern of smokeless use upside down from mainly older men to mainly young boys in high school sports.
I was just going to say, I grew up in Berwick, Pennsylvania, which is always wins the football championship of the state, and it was a huge use.
Well, they push it heavily to young white males in sports. Now, if you go to military pilots, these are mainly white ex-jocks, heavy snuff dippers. So the military was saying, hey, we've got pilots dipping snuff, some of them smoking cigarettes. How long can they be up there before they go into withdrawal, or is there withdrawal? And some of them are sneaking snuff up and taking their respirators off and spitting all over the cockpits. And they had to know, from their perspective, if there is a real withdrawal syndrome that could impair flight performance, this is critical. So all of a sudden, this became part of the military's critical need to know, to understand nicotine withdrawal. So they provided the support to help us set up performance assessment batteries. And those batteries became widely used among drug addiction researchers in the field throughout the 1980s. And the White House apparently was not willing to shut down the tobacco nicotine research that was specifically supported by the military. And that's how the Addiction Research Center got back into the tobacco nicotine business.
You are a wonderful storyteller, and I'm sorry we have to end.
Well, me too.
But I've got to find this baby.
But that's basically the end of the story.
Thank you.